many Quakers as it changes to, take to change a light bulb. We'll never know because we can't find the switch. And it really is bizarre. It's kind of one of the things that sort of annoys you after a while. You think, shh, you know, it's got to be somewhere. And we'll probably find it on the way out. But anyway, I mean, it's going to... If I keep looking around kind of in an inquisitive manner, it's probably lusting, oh, maybe it's on the leg of the piano or something. Anyway. Okay. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's very nice to be with you all. And I've just come from a very lovely weekend in Montrose. And everyone has been very warm and welcoming and very polite, and that's very nice. Though I do know from experience that there's often some unasked questions and some quietly whispered rumours. So one thing I'd just like to get out of the way before we start is people often say, privately or to other people, what about the name? Okay? Why the name? So I'm just going to clear that out of the way. I was, my parents were really very strict atheists. My father intellectually so, my mother emotionally so. And my father was 48 when he got married. And really, they were not expecting to have a child. And then amazingly, and I'm very pleased about this, I came along and even though they were such strict atheists, they decided to call me Benjamin, which in the Bible is, you know, the last born of elderly parents, in a sense. And so that's how I got to be called Ben. So that's great. So I'm glad we've cleared all that up. Just move on. So, I also then later, in my even earlier 20s, before I met Adja and young friends, went to live in an anarchist peace camp. Okay, the People's Peace Camp at Warrington, just outside the US Air Base at Burton Wood. And we were very awkward anarchists. We were, you know, anarchism's about nobody having power over anybody else. So we're all very strong individualists, doing our own thing. And we couldn't agree whether to cut the fence or not cut the fence, whether just being at this camp was enough, or, you know, whether we would sign on or not sign on, and these sorts of things. And in fact, one day somebody copied somebody else's haircut, and we all had, you know, weird and wonderful haircuts. I had pink hair in a Mohican style, but I didn't want it to be violent. So I just didn't spray it up, and it just flopped down over one eye, and I could see out of the other eye, and you know, that was okay. Anyway, someone copied someone else's haircut. They liked the colour, they liked the style. You know, we had nothing to do all day, so we could, like, and then almighty row broke out. We were pacifists, but, you know, really. And they said, you've nicked my haircut. Oh, we're all individual, we're allowed to be, no, we're all meant to be different. And, you know, so, and it was interesting how the possibility of difference moves into the prescription of difference. And we may want to return to that when we think about friends. Anyway, the reason now I see why anarchism has never become a mass movement is there's just not enough haircuts to go around. You know, it's so, anyway. So that was 1984. It was a time of great hope. And possibility. The miners were striking. We were outside the airbase. We had an amazing demonstration called Stop the City, which took the police totally by surprise. And we were, you know, literally hundreds or thousands of us in the streets of the City of London, stopping the traffic and just stopping things happening. And I was arrested about 8 times during that year for, you know, all good kind of Quakerly things like breach of the peace and obstruction of the police, and, you know, so I wasn't a Quaker at that point. And at the end of that year, I thought, I don't think there's going to be a revolution in Britain. You know, we're just a little bit generally conservative and comfortable, actually. That's probably the main thing that gets in the way. So I thought, actually, there's no point sitting on this roundabout And I mean, we were doing all kinds of weird and wonderful things. I'd changed my name to Pink Dandelion. In fact, the only thing we could all agree to do together, the only thing, was we would change our names to something silly. And we, you know, found great unity over this. As a way of protesting at the way the father's names passed on. Why just the father's name? So we'd have obviously changed names, and in that way it would be very clear that we were, you know, and people say, how can you? So June the 21st, 1984, I became Pink Dandelion. And that is my legal name, is just Pink is the first name and Dandelion the second name. And before that, my surname was Stout. And what's interesting about that is every time I went through a passport control, someone said, oh, Mr. Stout, who obviously isn't. You know. And Pink Dandelion never had any trouble at all. So, amazing. So, anyway, so there we go. And so the more formal that things become, the more likely you're going to see Pink Dandelion on it rather than Ben Pink Dandelion. I mean, I always wanted to be called Ben, but at that point I didn't know anyone I liked who needed my surname. So at the end of that year, though, I thought there was not going to be a revolution. Right, I'm looking for a pacifist, leaderless, voteless group like the anarchists who are going to bring about social change. Okay, sort of a reformist revolution. And I had been, my atheist parents, when faced with sending me either to a Catholic school in Carlisle or the Quaker school at Wigton, had sent me to the Quaker one to do me the least harm. Okay? So I was sort of aware of Quakers and had attended in Manchester when I was briefly studying hotel management before that seemed too capitalist for me. So I decided to get a job. Which is, again is antithetical to anarchists. Anarchists believe in withdrawing your labour from the labour market to bring the system down. And we used to really be quite mean to the Marxists who'd come along after a week's work and who'd voted, obviously, and been told by their leaders that they could. So we hadn't really... Anyway, I thought, well, I'll get a job and I'll move south where there's more sunshine. I trained to be a chauffeur and went to work in Brighton doing chauffeuring. So, and I went to meeting. And I was such an awkward inquirer. So for all of these times, and you really need to, I give thanks to Brighton friends for being very gentle and patient. But for whoever walks through the door, we've got to bear in mind that, you know, they yet may one day find themselves to be the decided Quaker. But I came in, I was like, still, really a bit kind of, sort of, competitive. We'd have a shared meal, and I'd bring a pot that said vegan food, the true pacifist option. So, I had the remnants of a floppy pink Mohican, and of course I had this rather awkward name, so people would say, hello, welcome, and who are you? And I said, well, I'm Ben. And they'd say, Ben, because we don't use titles here. I said, well, actually, I'm not really Ben. I'm Pink Dandelion, please call me Ben. I said, don't worry, we will. And at that time, you couldn't go to business meeting unless you were a member. And I was a kind of activist, and I wanted to get involved. And so after only 6 months in that meeting, I applied for membership. And as is common, I'm sure, in lots of our meetings, they were very eager. You know, he was a young friend, someone who'd been to a Quaker school, so they obviously knew all about Quakerism. Not true. But I'd read quite a lot. I, you know, knew my way around Christian faith and practice. And I wanted to go to business meeting. And they said, well, Pink. I said, sorry, you can call me Ben. No, it's okay, Pink, because they were being really, very trying to be very kind. And I was admitted to membership after 6 months. And I think it was way too soon. And I should have been asked to wait. I had no sense of a spiritual life at that point. I had probably what might be called an optimistic agnosticism. But the atheism of my parents made total sense to me. We'd had a very moral upbringing. It was basically a sort of moral hedonism. You know, do whatever you want to do. Whatever makes you happy is good as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. You know, and there was no, sort of, so it felt, in a very clear about what was right and what was wrong. So, a year later, on a Greyhound bus in America, I had an unexpected and unbidden spiritual experience of being lifted up and held by what I then called God. And one of the things about coming from an atheist background is that you don't have a kind of an immediate vocabulary or tradition into which to fit your spiritual experience. Quakerism then made absolute sense to me. Business meeting took on a new hue because I was aware of being gathered and guided in a very personal way, and therefore us sitting for often hours in silence to discern made sense to me in a way that it hadn't really before. I'd understood it intellectually, but now I felt it in my heart. And I've been a friend now, obviously, since then, so about the last 30 years now. And I've become very involved, and I've had the joy of working for friends, both at the yearly meeting and at Woodbrook. So, and it's been a very jammy life in many ways. And I've been, you know, basically released to think about Quakerism and Quakers. And like lots of you, I've read The Friend every week, and a little bit like reading a newspaper, you probably head to the back first or the middle back, and you know. And but I've been aware that there's been, you know, lots of great things that we've accomplished in the last 3 decades. We've, you know, withheld the portion of our tax that goes to military purposes as a yearly meeting. We've made statements against poverty and against racism. We've maintained statements against the lottery. We have the Canterbury commitment about being a low-carbon church. We've done amazing work, I think, in reconciliation in Northern Ireland, in Nagaland, in a whole range of places. And more recently, we've been at the forefront of the campaign for equal marriage. This has been fantastic things. And it's great that we're still so active in our Quaker witness. And at the same time, though, looking through The Friend every week, you become aware of various perennial debates and, you know, perennial uncertainties, in a sense. Should we or should we not have friends' schools? Well, that comes around about every year. And in the 1980s and 90s, are we Christocentric or are we universalist? Sorry. A discussion that's now been replaced by whether we're theist or non-theist, or rather, what is Quakerism essentially? And how broad can it or should it be? And of course, the we are changing all the time as well. So we're a group now where 88% of us are coming in as adults, at the average age of 43, but, you know, at any point in our lives. Our average age as a group is about 64. And although as we're looking through the pages of The Friend, we're likely to live to about 110, which is one of the benefits of converting to Quakerism. So, and I often tell people that. So... But we've got probably more people coming in than we've ever had since the 17th century. And that's a great thing. Quakerism's attractive, and people are interested in our meetings, curious, spiritually curious, and we offer a place for them to explore that, for us to explore that. And I should say that my own spirituality has shifted hugely in the time that I've been a Quaker. So there I was on the bus, and I had the sense of what I've called God sort of saying, well, Ben, whatever you want to do, I'm right behind you. And then after a few years, this isn't really working very well, is it? You're making a continual mess of things. And I think probably listening a bit more might help. And so for me, words like obedience, faithfulness, discernment are a part of my daily vocabulary, part of my attempted daily practice. So we create a space where people can come in and we can explore together, and some of us will leave at the other end, because actually Quakerism is the vehicle for now. It's the one that works for us. But as 21st century British Quakers, we don't imagine it's the only path up the mountain. That would horrify us if we look back to the 17th century and see the kind of certainty and confidence that those Quakers had, that they were the true church. We probably would feel a little awkward if one of those people came into our meeting. Mission to the Pope, 1658. Now imagine if that had gone well. You know, friend's house in Rome. Yes, I'm just off to sufferings. It's going to be tough, but I've got the suntan lotion. In that interview with the Pope, and it's a debate whether this actually happened, but the Quaker says to the Pope, well, one of the things the Pope says to the Quaker is, don't you have to do anything then for the remembrance sake of our blessed Saviour? You just sit there in silence. You know, and if you look at other liturgies, it's about, you know, doing outward things to remember and anticipate. And this Quaker says, no, for I have him in and about me continually. Basically, as early friends, they felt they'd been entered into a new space, a new sort of intimacy with the divine. But with that came this great certainty and confidence. And later in the conversation, it's, you know, there's, you say you're a descendant of Peter, the Quaker says to the Pope, but you're nothing like Peter. Peter was a simple fisherman, and look at you in your grand clothes in this huge palace. Peter was a fisher of people's souls, and you put hooks in people's souls to confound them. Peter was a follower of Christ. Thou art indeed the Antichrist. Okay. So, he didn't fare very well, this Quaker. But the important thing is that he was that clear. And right the way and through to about the 1820s, Quakers would claim to be the true church. Well, we're not like that now. We're one faith, you know, one faith amongst many and none. And I suspect that we wouldn't even think that someone must have some kind of faith commitment. You know, if we went out to the street and someone said they're an atheist, we'd say, okay, you know, we respect that as a position. So we've become a lot more permissive and, in a sense, seeing ourselves alongside the world rather than against it. And I think, you know, most of us are drawn by that. We enjoy that sense of not being totally sure that we're right. In fact, we're almost totally sure that we're not quite right. I mean, we're not quite right, but we're, you know, that we would never have the final word on God. Because actually, spirituality isn't that kind of a thing. Religion isn't that kind of a thing. If anything, we're rather cautious about groups that think they do have the final word. You know. So we're sort of certain of being at least a little bit uncertain, because that's the nature of spirituality. And that applies to us as a group and also to individuals. I say, if you ever want to leave friends, and it's not always very easy to do that, because the area meeting might send people to labour with you. Or, you know, you might have a crisis of faith, for example, and, you know, they'd come along and say, it's okay, doubt is valid. We all go through these periods, you don't need to leave. So, but if you did want to leave, actually it would be better to have a sort of a, rather than a crisis of faith, have a moment of blinding clarity, where you rush into a meeting and say, I've got it for all people, for all time, and you need to listen to me. Well, friend, you may be happier with that other group up the road. So, we've made a strength of being a seeking church, seeking faith group. And with that has come an internal permissiveness as well, a sense that, well, who is any one of us to say, well, this is what God's like? And I would certainly, you know, even though I have a very clear personal sense of what God's like for me, I wouldn't imagine it would be the same for anyone else, necessarily. Or even that that is the way that God is. I'm interpreting my experience. I'm trying to make sense of my spiritual experience with the language that I have. And that's, I think, how we are in a liberal yearly meeting. that we're sure of not being totally sure. What I've called the absolute perhaps. That we're perhaps about our theology in a very definite way. If ever anyone's an absolute absolute, they will indeed be happier somewhere else. I can't read this. It's always the same problem. I'm sorry. At the same time, though, we are in a group whose membership has dropped by about a third in the time that I've been around. And so we have increased pressures and challenges. And we're living in a culture that's increasingly secular, where the religious is marginalised or seen as slightly odd. So I travel to America fairly frequently, and I've been sitting standing in a supermarket queue, and someone would say, "Oh, which church do you go to?" Okay, nice little icebreaker in the supermarket queue. Now, I don't know what it's like in Scotland, but in England, that needs to be seen to be a little bit odd. In Kansas, I was asked, "Well, when did you first give your life to Christ?" as a little supermarket queue icebreaker. So, do you need some water? Yeah. No, it's okay. And we're also in a culture that's increasingly individualistic, we enjoy this. We enjoy having choices, and we want to exercise those choices. So we have 88% of us coming in as adults out of, and only a third of us are coming from somewhere, some other faith affiliation. Most people are like me, coming from an absence. And we're coming in the midst of a secular and individualist culture. And I think that, in a sense, as a group, we've been possibly over-permissive in the last 30, 40 years. We've been hungry, as my meeting was, for its new member, without really interrogating the spiritual element of that commitment. We've been very keen to say, "Well, if you'd like to be part of us, that's great. If you feel at home, then that means you're a member." So. And I've become concerned in a way that we've possibly weakened our community by being too generous to the individual at times. We may need to have said, as I think I should have been told, "Just wait for a year. Go around a few other meetings. Or at least wait until you have some sense of what we're about, sort of inwardly. It's not just about, yes, I understand that this committee meets and. Because there's nothing wrong in waiting. And what's become clear to me is... Sorry, does anyone else need water? Like some water? Okay, thanks. Is that we're doing two things. One is we are building up our Quakerism as people come in. And in any one meeting, there will be a group of people who look after the heart of our meeting life. But we're also, and I think this is important, that we're also offering this to everyone. And so what's important is we stop from just looking inwardly and say, how do we nurture ourselves, into saying, what is this like for someone coming through the door? How will it be for them? Are we ready to answer their questions? And it may or may not be that those people become ultimately part of that group that looks after the fabric of the meeting. And that's fine. I know in my meeting, we were kind of getting slightly disgruntled. People coming 7, 8 years and saying almost proudly, "Well, I've never read Faith and Practice." We said, if you're coming, you should be somehow getting more involved or becoming more literate in the Quaker ways. But actually, we now realize, no, because for some people, all they need to do is come. And they'll come and they'll go, and that's fine. We're not just inducting people into a cozy circle or a closed group. We need to be a group that's out there, visible, and saying we're offering something for everyone, regardless of the level of commitment that you might ultimately find. We need to become, in a way, a bit more denominational, I think, a bit more open to the outsiders. So in some ways, it's no surprise that Yearly Meeting then had this three-year exercise on what it means to be a Quaker. It might seem rather strange that, you know, as a group we'd do that. I mean, do we not know? Well, maybe we don't, I concluded. Maybe we weren't quite sure about what it means to be a Quaker. Because there's these perennial debates about, well, is it okay to be a non-theist, or is it okay still to be a theist? What does it mean in terms of lifestyle? Does it mean you should go to meeting at least once a month? So. And I was asked, probably in 2012, I suppose, if I would give the Swarthmore Lecture in 2014 on that theme. And the committee was lovely. You know, they said, Ben, well, they rang up and said, well, we met today and we discerned that your name occurred to us, and we wondered if you would be prepared to, you know, deliver the 2014. And I said, yes, okay. They said, that's a little bit quick. I said, well, if you've discerned, you know, part of my thing is, if, you know, who am I to challenge that? So, they said, oh, okay. And then you go and meet the committee once as the new lecturer to be. You know. And they said, what's important, Ben, is this is your lecture. You know, your name's occurred. We want you to do what you need to do, what you're called to do. And there's about 15 people in the room, and you go around the room, and everyone said, but if you could say a little bit about global Quakerism, that would be great. If you could reflect on 20 years of teaching at Woodbrook, that would be lovely. I'd like you to say something about the importance of history. Okay. But it's your lecture. And I set aside a month not going to Woodbrook. I thought, I will go upstairs in our house and I will have profound thoughts on the top floor, and I will have a whole month, and, you know, hopefully I will be literally inspired. So, and two things got in the way of that. It was at that very moment, at the beginning of that month, that, after a whole series of unfortunate and unfortunate events, that a little puppy arrived. I'm still, anyway, how it happened, you know, but anyway, there was a line at some point over dinner, maybe we could get a dog, and that was it, anyway, and this lovely little thing arrived, and of course you do what you need to do with a puppy, so every hour, take it outside. Or, after any meal, or after any moment of excitement. Okay? Ooh. So I was downstairs, actually, in the kitchen, and our kitchen's a rather busy place, and I was, you know, IC puppy training, and so, oh, hour, right, okay. So actually, I was sitting there with the laptop, and everything was going on, you know, people coming in, chatting, and, you know, so. And added to which, amazingly, and for the first time ever, I had food poisoning, which lasted for 2 weeks. It was incredible. Public health came round, where had I bought this, and what had I done with that, and where had I eaten, and who had I shaken hands with, and anyway, so often, it was me running out the door, not the puppy. And then, of course, coming back for the puppy, because, oh no, I can't leave the puppy in there. So, to be fair, it wasn't the best of circumstances, and when the first draft went to the committee, it was like all over the shop. But there was also something about the tone that didn't go down very well with the committee, and I had 8 pages of rather strong comments from 2 members of the committee. And at that point, I thought, you know what you can do with my lecture. So, however, 24 hours later, it's always worth having a 24-hour rule before you respond. If you're feeling a little bit emotional or passionate about something. So, 24 hours later I felt better. I thought, this is their stuff, and I will carry on. And I was then able to produce something that was a little easier, I think. Their concern was that people would get to about page 3 and just shut the book, because it was a little bit competitive. And it's interesting that people have said, well, I read the book and I thought I should resign, and then I heard the lecture that you gave at Bath, and I thought, that's okay then. So maybe I'm just, this story of my life just mellowing all the time. So. But it may be just about presentation, and it may be about misunderstandings. Essentially, I say, well, what it means to be a Quaker, there are four things. I'm not keeping an eye on the time, by the way. Okay. So, there are four things. The first is that we are rooted in an experience of encounter with the divine. And even if we haven't experienced it, we know that is our hope in meeting. It is at the basis of all we do, is that we believe that with anything, without anything outward, you know, without a particular front or stained glass or music or separated priests or outward sacraments, that we can have a connection with God, the Holy, the Divine, and some kind of powerful spiritual experience. That's what Fox, George Fox, discovers in 1647. When he said, all my hopes in all men were gone, and I had nothing outwardly to help me. Then I heard a voice which said, there is one, even Christ Jesus, that can speak to thy condition. And he says, and when I heard it, my heart did leap for joy. And I saw that why there was none upon the earth that could speak to my condition, namely that I should give him all the glory. He'd been looking in the wrong places. He'd been, you know, talking to professors and all this kind of thing, and reading books, and he was looking in the wrong place. It was about a direct experience. And importantly, unlike lots of other Christian prophets, he felt that this was an experience that was available to everybody. He had no spiritual authority above anyone else. Okay? None of us do. We are ministers together, part of the priesthood of all believers. And obviously that was a message that just caught fire. Men, women and children were all ministers in the church, and everyone would be saved. Well, we don't talk a lot about the language of salvation now, but that sense of spiritual equality and spiritual possibility is at the heart of our Quaker experience and the way we organize ourselves. No one has more spiritual authority than anyone else. We'll have different spiritual gifts. Some of us will teach, and some of us will be treasurers, and some of us will be clerks, and some of us will, you know, be excellent at getting the room just right for meeting, and all those are equal and significant gifts. But no one has greater spiritual authority than anyone else. So at the heart, the basis, is that encounter with the divine. And it's a grand claim. We need to recognize that. Compared with other Christian groups, we're sweeping aside everything that they feel is necessary for a faithful life, and saying we don't need any of that because we have this direct connection that is so vital and strong that it gives us all that we need. All we need is a space to meet in, and we will lead faithful lives. Okay? So it's grand stroke arrogant in theological terms. For any group, though, that is led by the Spirit or led by God, then we need to know when that is happening and when we may just be lost in our own imaginations. And so discernment is absolutely crucial. We need to have a method of working out what is authentic and what is not. What's just a good idea and what is a leading. And we've done that over 3.5 centuries. We've developed really good, strong, practiced methods of discernment, whether it's in our business meetings or with clearness committees or even in, you know, sort of personal support groups. We get to know what it is when we're discerning faithfully. We become practiced at it individually as well as a tradition. And the third element then is that we want to have a form of worship that's going to nurture that sense of encounter. Basically, you know, it's a wonderful thing. It's that amazing space that this Quaker talking to the Pope talked about. I have him in and about me continually. It's being lifted out of our old selves and taken into this new place. So let's have a form of worship that really tries to nurture that. And for us in Britain, we have maintained silence and stillness as the basis of our liturgical form. And elsewhere in the Quaker world, they've gone in slightly different ways, but still with that idea of direct encounter at the root of their Quakerism. And the fourth element is that we know that out of that experience of encounter comes a push, a holy kind of impellation to do work in the world, to make it a better place, to bring social justice, to work for peace. That's run right the way through our spiritual history. Now there's, I mentioned in the lecture there were three sort of provisos about that. I'll just run through those quickly. And then I'll introduce a fourth, which came to me last night. The three things are, first of all, it's low on doctrine. Okay, we're in British Quakerism, we have that sense of spiritual experience, but as I've said, we're a perhaps kind of church theologically, so we haven't got a strong, thick doctrine about the nature of God. We are able to write minutes and epistles and produce a book of discipline. But most of the book of discipline is descriptive rather than prescriptive. It's not saying this is what God's like. So, we have a sense of the holy. We know it in our hearts. And we know that language can't quite match that experience. And so we're low on doctrine. But we do have a theology. It's not that there's nothing there just because we can't talk about it very easily. You know, if the encounter with the divine is at the root of our experience, then obviously the divine is there. We have a theology that there's something we connect with that offers us guidance. Traditionally, we've called it the will of God. We've been discerning the will of God in our business meetings. So we do have a theology. We're not a humanist group. We're a religious society of friends, not a society of friends. And I remember a phrase in Meeting for Sufferings in the late 80s where one friend stood up and said, if this was the society of friends, I would say this is the most illogical way forward. We are the religious society of friends. And I feel strongly led that we should follow this proposal. It's not about logic or head stuff. It's not actually about consensus. It's about seeking the will of God. And it's not a human process. As is true of ministry and meeting, it's what comes through us. We are called to be faithful vessels. So. The second proviso is that this is an inherently collective enterprise. And it's, again, very interesting. We look back to the early friends. They had amazing spiritual experience. They didn't just then say, great, I'm saved. I'm going back to the farm. Okay? What happened instead is that they left their farms and homes and followed the movement. There's something about the experience that binds and weaves us together. And we know that our discernment and our worship and our witness all work better when we work together. We will achieve far more. So. And indeed, with discernment, we have a sense of greater reliability with more people. We don't need masses of people. It's not about numbers, but three is better than one. So. And the third point about this list of four elements is that I think it's inherently about transformation. That we can't encounter the divine and remain untouched by that experience. Now, if we look in Faith and Practice, there's some wonderful accounts of really life-changing transformation. We can think of George Fox, and the passage I just mentioned at 1902 about him hearing a voice. We can think of James Naylor, you know, out in the fields. We can think of Margaret Fell crying in her pew that we have been thieves, just thieves of the scriptures. And more recently, there's the Amelia Fogelklou account of her preparing for a class in a back garden and feeling in a low place, but being lifted out of that, struck dumb by the love of God. But there's also the incremental journey, and that may be the one we're more familiar with, where step by step we feel we are given more, and what's important is that we live up to that measure. and then more still may be given us. My experience has been of ebbing and flowing. Early friends talked about the serpent's head being bruised, and I've often wondered, how many times does the serpent's head need to be bruised in my life before I get it right? So, it's not now necessarily one lovely light bulb moment, but it's just moving backwards and forwards. And by transformation, I simply mean seeing things in a different way. So in terms of the sort of spiritual marketplace, if the Quakers set up a stall, we would say, well, we're open for transformation. We believe that in our meetings, we can encounter the divine, and that is necessarily transformative. More than that, it will push us to a place where we are then called to help transform the world. So we're transformed in order to transform. And hence the title of the lecture, Open for Transformation. And we aren't a Quaker, but we are Quaker in the way that we then live our lives, the way our testimony, our life, preaches to the rest of the world. But the fourth thing, I think, is that came to me last night, is that it's easy for us to think, oh yes, that's good, and I quite like that one. But actually, these aren't, and it's this list of four elements, the sort of encounter and discernment and worship and witness, are not inseparable. They're totally bound up. You can't take one without the other. And I think we're in danger of doing that. So, well, yeah, I'm strong on the witness, not sure about the encounter. Or, I love business meeting more than worship. Or, you know, are you a QPSW friend or a Quaker Life friend? Well, we're both and always. It's the same kind of habit we've got into about separating testimony into different testimonies, like simplicity and peace and integrity, and then saying, well, I'm strong on peace, but I do have a problem with simplicity because I love that third car, or whatever, speaking personally. So, though I'm better now. Anyway. You know, or we say, well, I might come to a meeting or I might not, or I tend to come, you know, when the biscuits are better or something. Or, you know, we make all kinds of choices. It's become we're in danger of becoming a sort of a religion of individualism, of just choosing the bits we like. And those four things are inextricably linked, and I didn't make that clear enough in the lecture. The other misconception, I think, there's a couple of misconceptions. Because I use the term God in the lecture quite a lot, some people have said, oh, you just want to make us all into kind of God Quakers. Well, I was using the language of faith and practice. I'm also using my language. And unlike a whole range of Quaker publications, I didn't then say, but I'm just using this and please translate. Because part of what I hope we can do is then use our own language with integrity and without apology. You know, we just need to get on with it. For heaven's sake, we should be able to use the term God if that's important for us, and not be worried about it if it isn't. So, and as I say, it is the language of our Book of Discipline. So it's not that I want to push a particular theology as such, but I want to keep the theology within Quakerism. I don't want to take us back 50 years, as someone suggested, or 100 years. I'm a very liberal friend. I'm an absolute perhaps kind of friend. I'm very happy with diversity. Here I am, having come out of an atheist tradition rather than a clearly Christian one. You know, I'm just weaving around like everyone else. I'm not trying to get us back into the Quaker grey, necessarily. Well, not at all, no. So, but it's about going forwards, rather, with more confidence and more clarity and more joy. I think we're worn down slightly by trying to do all that we ever have done, but with fewer people. And we may be able to pay for more staff. My area meeting is now paying for a bookkeeping service. Other area meetings have secretaries. maybe we'll be releasing elders soon, you know, seeing if they can pay him for some time. But maybe we just need to do less. You know, maybe we need to audit all of our nominations in our meetings and think, do we need to make all these appointments? And how far do we need to struggle to fill a post? Is there someone with the gifts for this post, or is there not? And if there isn't, then maybe we don't do it this year. So. We also need to become more confident about what is Quaker and what isn't, I think. So to be clear about, I mean, it says in the beginning of chapter 11 what it is to be a member. It says it's to accept the fundamental elements of being a Quaker, to say to yourself and the world, do you accept these? And then it lists the fundamental elements. It's incredibly clear, which include corporate divine guidance and a commitment to our testimony. So it should be fairly clear for both the applicant and for the area meeting who is and who is not a member. It should be fairly clear to us what it's okay to do in worship and what it isn't. So in my area meeting recently, we've had two very difficult situations, and one was partly because someone continued to text through the meeting. Okay, now, what's the criteria we might use for what's okay to do in meeting? Well, one thing is it disturbing anyone else? Well, yes, it is. Do we think it's appropriate as an activity? Well, no, it isn't. And can that person still worship while they text? Well, then, of course, well, what's worship about? So I thought, in the early morning, well, we might say, would you do this during the Eucharist in a church service? Well, maybe someone would, I don't know. But, I mean, in a sense, we're involved in an hour-long communion, a kind of an intimacy with the divine. Okay, would you do this if you were being embraced? That might be a good thing. So some people read at the beginning of meeting and that helps them center down, but we don't expect someone to read right the way through meeting. Would you still be holding the book as you are embraced? Would you still have the phone and be tapping away at the thing as you were being embraced? I mean, that's just a suggested question, some kind of criteria. You're being embraced. Would you do this at that moment of holy intimacy? And what's important in those moments is that we act quickly and confidently. That we don't hedge around and say, well, you know, how is it for you with the telephone in the meeting? And they might say, well, I really need that phone. You know, I really need to send messages because it's that time of the day. And we might say, oh, okay, you know. And there may be a need, but the chances are it's a preference. And what happened in the meeting, in our area meeting, is that this person carried on texting because they weren't challenged about it. And they brought their friends in because they said, hey, this Quaker thing's good. You can do what you like here. And so the whole meeting fragmented and broke down. And the elders and overseers were unable, well, it's really an eldership issue, were unable to confront the friend. And partly, I mean, it was a very strong character, but partly as well, it was a lack of confidence, but it was also a betrayal of the community, in a sense, because what it meant was that the individual was allowed to carry on at the cost to the community. And one of the things that elders need to do is realize that we're there to nurture our faith community. And that may mean putting the community first. And then there may be an oversight situation where the person who may feel deeply offended that they can't text anymore, you know, that their hurt is worked with. In the end, we ended up with a disownment situation because this person was just unable to accept what was Quaker and what was not. They wanted to do things their way and they were very assertive about it. So, And that wasn't very easy because we love everyone. And we want everyone to be part of our meetings, and we don't really want there to be any conflict. So it's very difficult to say to someone, well, no, we admitted you to membership, but now we don't feel you understand the Quaker way. There isn't that strong connection with Quakerism that it talks of in chapter 11. And when someone's then hurt and upset, it's very difficult. We want to back down and say, we want to be forgiven because we feel we've hurt them if we've been the person who's needed to confront them. But in absolutely every case, we may need to move quickly, and we need to put the community first. It was very interesting when we talked to the local Church of England vicar. He said, "Oh, yeah, we have that trouble all the time. That's why we've got church wardens. That's their job. Anyone out of order, keep them outside." Oh, okay. Oh, it's like an anathema to us as Quakers. We don't know, you know. But we do. We're offering a public worship, but we need to protect that worship experience. It's not a free-for-all. We're not a do-it-yourself religion. We're a do-it-together one. And I use the analogy in the lecture of those little masks that are supposed to come down, like I've never experienced this, you know, in an aeroplane in case of an oxygen loss or something. And you're told to put your mask on first before helping the person next to you. Well, as Quakers, we need to put our mask on first and then deal with a hurt individual. We need to put the community first and be really clear. And my hope is then we'll also be enjoying our Quakerism. I mean, these are these isolated stories, but they're illustrative of the way in which we may have been over-accommodating. In that case, our area meeting was too quick to let that person into membership. We didn't ask enough things. We didn't find out enough. So, and it ended in a messy way that we could have avoided, actually. If we can be serious, we can have more fun, I think. You know, if we're clear about what our Quakerism is, then we can joke about it a little bit and, you know, kind of enjoy all the Quaker craziness and quirkiness. So, when we're strong about our own faith position, we can listen more respectfully to others. We're having less buttons pressed by other people's theologies. We can work more strongly in ecumenical circles and interfaith circles. We may have hopefully made peace with our previous affiliations and be able to re-engage with those places without feeling they're toxic. And if we actually end up being able to do less work, then hopefully we'll have more energy and more joy. And I give the example in the lecture of my meeting, which is wonderful and was also startling. It has no rotors. It has a clerk and a treasurer, no assistant clerk, no other. I mean, it really is Quaker light, you know. It has one elder, one overseer, one trustee. Has no notices at the end of meeting. We just, you know, there's no rota for the tea because whoever gets to the kettle first puts it on. So, if anyone wants a drink in meeting, they're likely to eventually find the kettle. Okay? Do this. And what the result of all this is, there is immediate fellowship at the end of meeting. The focus isn't on, you know, either a long list of notices or doing a mass of business between all the different appointees, but actually of just moving around saying, hi, who are you, you know, how are things, and and we do lots of things that help build community. And that's important. We have a midweek meeting every month for half an hour, followed by up to 2 hours in the local cafe. That's the important bit. We had a grand day out to yearly meeting last year because we kept saying it's amazing to go to yearly meeting. It's fantastic to have 1,000 friends discerning. You need to feel this experience. Preston, London, 2 hours, 10 minutes. Sorry, I live in Lancashire. 2 hours, 10 minutes. We get down there for 12, 6 hours of yearly meeting back, you know. Perfect. 10 people out of the 15 who come to meeting wanted to come on our grand day out. engineering works. Bank holiday Saturday. 3.5 hours to London and 3.5 hours back. And we had a train expert with us, and apparently we went on some track that's very rarely used. Anyway, so, oh no, and only like 5 hours at yearly meeting. But the 7 hours was of equal worth to the 5 hours. Because we had such amazing conversations, got to know each other, found out about Dorothy's incredible bag, which is like Mary Poppins' and anything anyone needed, she had it in there. Oh, I've got a spare tuna sandwich. Oh, aspirin, or you know, whatever it was, it just appeared out of this thing. It was a gift we hadn't appreciated before, just meeting her for, you know, an hour after worship on Sunday. So we really got to know each other better. And then we had yearly meeting, and our preparative meeting the following day was so good. We were so disciplined, having seen 1,000 friends do it. And if they could do it, so could the 7 of us. So, so we've got huge amounts going for us. We've got a very particular kind of spirituality that should be very appealing to people. We're offering this seeking space. We have a brilliant method of worship that works for us, and we have ways of discerning. And we have a strong record of witness that comes out of that. We've got a lot going for us. I just would like us to hopefully feel more empowered to be Quaker and to be more confident about what is Quaker and what isn't. And it's not that everyone else is wrong, it's just that this is where we are. And we can love everybody that comes through the door, and hopefully many will. We've got National Quaker Week coming up and World Quaker Day. So, but it doesn't mean then that everyone either wants to become part of the core group, as it were, or that everyone is necessarily a member. And it's just about drawing those boundaries and making the permissive slightly clearer what is permissive and what isn't. So, and we need to stop worrying. If you look at the letters pages of the Friend, I really am going to finish in a minute, we're full of worry. I mean, there's an awful lot of pedantry as well. I sent in a letter about the joy of our lovely new wood pellet boiler. Just fantastic, because it was an ecological solution, that meeting houses could get a wood pellet boiler and get a feed-in tariff for 20 years. You know, it's just, and the next week there's a letter, and I hope the person isn't here. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'm ready to talk to you. So, saying, well, the problem with wood pellet boilers is that they have to be cleaned out every time you use, which isn't true. Anyway, it's just such a kind of dampening down. So, and we worry about numbers, and we get het up about theological debates, and I just think there's a lot of energy we're using that we might be able to maintain for other things, to put the faith back at the heart of our Quakerism. Fear is a secular thing. Okay, it's something that when we lose faith, we get fear. If we have faith, we go forward with hope, and that's my prayer really for us as a society. Okay. So we still have some time for any reflections or comments or questions. Well, we have a higher percentage of people joining us as adults. In other words, fewer people who've been with us from birth. But our numbers overall are going down, as is common for, you know, faith groups in Britain. But at the same time, interestingly, we have more meetings than we've just about ever had. So we have more meetings, but they're smaller. And of course now, we're expecting every meeting to fulfill all the functions of a meeting. We've done away with that recognized category that we used to have. And it was interesting, a couple of weeks ago, Mosedale meeting put something in the Friends saying, well, we're just becoming a worshipping group. So we're not having a clerk and a treasurer. And that may be a way through, that for some meetings, they might be under the care of others. Or those, you know, I mean, those Friends are still members of their area meeting. So we need to find out a bit more about that. But I think there are a number of meetings who might be like to be released from some of the expectations of our structures. Next week. Well, someone's going to have to unlock the door, as we found out today. So, okay, well, I can do that. I've got a key. Well, I'd like a cup of tea afterwards. So, I'll bring some milk then. Okay, and some tea. I mean, we don't need very much, actually, just to, you know, we need very little to actually worship together. And it's the other things we might need. If we've got a building, we're going to need to get into it. We'll have to pay the heating bills and whatever else. And if we do want a cup of tea with milk, we're going to need to bring some milk. So. And they ended up with they went from that point of nothing to three committees. Us, them, and stuff. All right? So there's the us committee. Well, around whatever we need to do. And there's the them around anything we might need to do with anyone else. And there's the stuff about the milk and the insurance and electricity or whatever. Very simple. We could start again. There's nothing, George Fox didn't go up Pendle Hill and have a vision of a great people to be gathered in white raiment with a particular committee structure. You know, I mean, there is a sense that we are trying to operate gospel order. You know, we're trying to be a church in the way that we feel God wants us to be. But then we've added a lot of detail, particularly in the last 100 years. You know, a lot of, in particular, as we've developed a central kind of a paid staff, and you know, that's really grown. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have that, and we're very grateful for all the wonderful work that's done. But we have made things rather complicated, and we might say, of course, which is quite easy to say, well, we wouldn't start from here. But, you know, and we've got, 400 meeting houses in Britain, of which 167 are listed. So we're, it's a lot of responsibility. Virtually all of our income in my lovely listed meeting house, which does indeed gaze over Pendle Hill, so of course we couldn't possibly sell it, but never mind, is virtually all the income goes on keeping the building going. It's a ridiculous amount of money just to be warm-ish on a Sunday. Per head, it's a ridiculous amount of money. So, we need to keep discerning about that. Sorry, friend.
You may have told us in the lecture, I can't remember, but can you say how and when the testimonies were formulated, and do you agree that simplicity
Okay, thank you. So when were the testimonies formulated? Well, that was an interesting thing because I've been working at Woodbrook for 23 years, and one day someone said, "You like flowcharts, Ben, do us a testimony flowchart." Because we know, for example, that early friends didn't celebrate Christmas and Easter. That was a time and season. But nowadays, you know, we're a little more, I mean, you start finding Christmas greetings in the Friend from 1961. So it's obviously, you know, Christmas has become a kind of Quaker thing in the 20th century. Hat honour. Well, we're not wearing hats now, but, you know, there's various things that have shifted. So I went back to the very first Book of Discipline, which is the first published one, was 1783, Book of Extracts. And I looked at this book, and actually the whole book is testimony. It's all about how we live in the world in alphabetically listed categories. So under M, it has mourning habits for when someone dies, and the fact that we shouldn't then take on the world's ways, and this kind of thing. H is hat honour. T for tithes. There's, you know, the whole of life is testimony, in my opinion. So what happens then is that gradually over the years, as the world seems to tolerate Quakers, we've tolerated the world more. And we've now got a few things that we're still sort of countercultural on. And the way, what happens is in 1952, Howard Brinton writes a book called Friends for 300 Years. And in it, he starts to make a list of testimonies because that's a helpful way of teaching the way in which Quakerism is lived. And by the 1990s, we have sort of acronyms like SPICE or STEPS. So simplicity, peace, integrity, community, equality. And we imagine that these are the Quaker testimonies and that they've always been like this. And then we start to divide them and sometimes divorce them from their spiritual basis, but divide them and say, well, as I said, I'm strong on simplicity, but peace is a tricky one for me. Okay? So the list as we know it is really quite recent. And I think the list is awkward because of that ability to divide it up and to see it as different things when it's actually all part of one thing. So in fact, testimony starts from day one. It starts from the moment that Fox has this experience and as a result of that maybe stops using the names for days and months and uses numbers instead. Starts to dress more plainly because he's worried about pride and vanity. Starts to use thee and thou rather than the deferential you because Quakerism is levelling society down. Okay. Now, I don't know, I mean, we could have a look and see how people are living. And in general, you know, we're a very particular demographic at the moment. There was a major survey of British Quakerism in 2013, and we're highly educated as a group. We're way beyond the national averages. We're more likely to be in the professional classes than the general population. We also are about 98.9% white. So it may be, if we then looked at how we were living, we would find that simplicity might be neglected. But one of the things that's also happened with this sort of formulation is that they've become quite broad categories. So instead of having a huge book with listing all things like mourning habits, where does mourning habits fit in? Well, maybe it's under simplicity. But what does simplicity mean? I think it was an invention in about the 1860s because Quakers wanted to move away from plain dress. And eventually that was a yearly meeting decision in 1861. And the discussion in yearly meeting, the discernment was about, well, we can live simply inwardly. And they moved the vocabulary from being plain to being simple. Well, simplicity is a very broad concept. Does it mean you buy the most reliable motor car ever, because it's not going to break down, and therefore you don't have to waste any mental or emotional energy on your car repairs? Okay, so that's a kind of one version of simplicity. Or do you go everywhere by bicycle and public transport? okay, which may take up more time, but may be more prayerful, or what, you know, I mean, so we're not even clear, I think, what simplicity means. So I can't then answer whether it's the most neglected. But similarly, peace is a very broad concept, and that's, again, 20th century. Before that was always the testimony against war. Well, but peace, I mean, you know, I've heard all kinds of things suggested under the rubric of what peace might involve, including assassination. So, in order to stop more people dying, just kill one. Well, you know, it's tricky. It's not really that tricky. It's not Quaker. Anyway.
I suppose I went back to the lecture when I was there, and having been in our area meeting for the lecture, I've seen that 6 times, with different groups of people, in different contexts. But the other thing that was true is I'm coming to the area meeting, nominations meeting, and I discovered on my computer who does what in the area meeting in 2008. So I ended up speaking at an early meeting and looking at that now. This was last year, this time.
Okay.
And I discovered 100 people that left early meeting either from doing things, either because they died, or they moved away, or they're now so elderly they need care.
Yes.
Sorry, not 100.
Oh.
That was 40 people.
Okay.
But they did 100 jobs.
Yes.
40 people did 100 jobs. In the meantime, 30 people that come into area meeting were doing 20 jobs. So there's a huge gap, 80 jobs not being done.
Yes.
Which the convener of area meeting nomination is the sharp point. So everything you were saying in your lecture actually is felt to be very, very real. And the examples you've given are about local meetings. And I think that's much easier, but area meetings are much more difficult to say, do we need elders, do we need overseers, do we need business meetings?
Sure.
That means the whole structure begins to fragment and break down. So you can't really do that in quite the same way. But the other thing that we've done is we've set up an area meeting review group. And in pairs we're visiting between the area meeting committees and the local meetings, that's one thing. Where we have conversations with people. And again, those kinds of issues are coming up.
Yes.
So, for me, it seems very real, but I think for a lot of people in area meeting, just having that dialogue is scary.
Yes, sure. Yeah, thanks. Well, yes. I mean, we've had this in my area meeting. And what we've now done is got minimum and maximum numbers for committees. So where we might have had two elders in a meeting or three, we said, well, we can manage with one if need be. It's not ideal, but that may be the way we need to go. So we, in my area meeting, we have elders and overseers and trustees, and we have no other committees, which is interesting. You know, and obviously area meetings differ. We're very small, but we've had to have that same conversation, and it may just be we can't sustain ourselves in the way that we have done. The other side of this is if we can get our outreach working and become welcoming places, we may have more people coming in. But of course, the last thing we want to do is take that new person's help. Good, you can become this. So there's going to be a lag, even if the outreach plan works. And in the meantime, we may need to, I mean, you know, it may be a real sharp edge, as you say. I mean, what can we not do? You know, and how many jobs could, you know, might we not have that we have now?
But the problem that I'm seeing, the sharp edge, is what you were saying.
Yeah.
The older generation, the ones who are playing longer, quicker.
Yes.
A lot of new people coming in, it's exhausting.
Yeah, sure.
And particularly if they've got very happy jobs with a very busy family, it's very difficult to say you have to give up some of that to be quick.
Yes. Well, we don't say that, and that's interesting, because if you joined in Philadelphia yearly meeting, one of the questions as part of your membership visit is, and which committee do you feel your gifts might be best used with? And you were immediately put on a committee as a member. We don't do that here. So in that sense, we're more permissive. We are aware that people have, you know, very busy lives and difficult situations, and we don't have an expectation of service from anybody. And as you say, we're aware that some people have served for decades and now need a break as well. So we are going to have to, you know, it may get to the point where we just can't do things in the way that we've been able to, and whether that may mean area meetings joining with other area meetings. So, you know, that's one possible way through. But it is difficult. Yeah. Yes. Well, the four elements that I mentioned, I think, can be shared across global Quakerism. Although when I add the provisos that we're, for example, low on doctrine, that would not be true of evangelical friends. And in the same way that we emphasize the way in which we're Quaker, they would emphasize what they would believe as Quakers. So at the beginning of their books of discipline, you're likely to find a statement of faith or a clear doctrinal element. And often when we meet at world gatherings, we're going like this, because the way in which we define our Quakerism is totally different. So, but I think, you know, the divine encounter is there. Discernment is important. All these groups are using Quaker business method as we'd recognize it. What's different is we have different forms of worship, but it's still trying to nurture that experience. And the witness work is shared, although we would find we would be in different places on certain political issues. Particularly, say, our commitment to equal marriage would not be shared by many evangelical yearly meetings, although many are discussing it. And I think, you know, that's very interesting as well. It's not off the radar for them. Equally, we might want to think about programmed worship, and it's about 90% of Quakers worldwide who would now be programmed, what we call programmed. So, and you would go in and you get given an order of service, and it might start with the robed choir or the handbell choir, or it might be a 5-piece electric band with the pastor as the lead singer. You know, I mean, all kinds of variety there, and we need to be careful about not just lumping it into one group. Worship is going to be longer than ours, and it's probably going to be followed by an education class, a first day class, or adult school. And if the sermon goes on a long time, then the period of silence or open worship might get squeezed. So it might look, from our point of view, as if they don't really value that. But of course, they've got this education thing starting, and I've seen a pastor tear up the order of service. Well, first of all, I know that pastors are trying to discern what worship will consist of in the week before. So they are still discerning. They're like elders and overseers, really. It's just that they're released for it. They're given sort of living, as it were. But equally, halfway through worship, the pastor, stroke brackets elder, then tears up the order of service and says, "No, I'm really feeling led, we should go another way. You know I have put this out, but I'm, you know, given what so-and-so just said, and we're, you know." And the other thing that can happen is that when you open a space in those friends' churches, they can be filled with prayer and testimony. Because many of the people who've come in are coming in from another tradition where silence is seen to be some kind of spiritual inadequacy. And you fill it with prayer and testimony. And so what some pastors are doing now is having two open spaces, one for prayer and testimony, and one for what they call communion after the manner of friends. So actually, we are definitely, in my opinion, still a world family of friends. There are family resemblances. But a lot of what I said about being permissive and a perhaps kind of church, that's very much about the liberal tradition. And some of the problems about being perhaps too accommodating are particular to us, because they'd be very clear. And they would have less freedom in worship. I mean, you know, nobody would have necessarily time to text. Be busy singing or praying or praising. Okay? So we have a particular set of situations, but we are also part of the world family. Thank you. Yes, please.
Yeah.
So we need to become better practiced. The question was about teaching. We need to become better practiced at communicating our faith, transmitting it, in the same way that we need to become better practiced at sharing our spiritual experience. So, I mean, as you say, it's not always very helpful to be told you've done it wrong when you didn't know about it in the first place. Hopefully our elders aren't just telling us when we've got it wrong, but we also when we're getting it right, because to elder is to nurture. We need to see that as a positive act. But we may need to find different ways of teaching more systematically. And I think some of these new materials are doing that, being friends together, becoming friends, and these sorts of things. But also, I mean, just speaking to each other, we should be able to do that. And one of the problems I think we have is that we're likely to give somebody something to read. Okay, and we just imagine everyone learns through reading. Well, I don't learn through reading. I learn through listening to people. And, you know, so someone comes in. There was a spoof kind of article in The Friend a few weeks ago about the person that comes to meeting and says, you know, I want to know about this theism thing or non-theism thing. Oh, well, ask that friend. They're the God friend. And then they go to the top, like, oh, yeah, what is about suffering? Oh, you need to go to that person. You know, or haven't you read this? Well, I don't want to read stuff, and when we do pick it up, it's not always in very accessible language. Because again, it's reflecting that highly educated demograph that we represent. So, you know, again, we need to think far more about the person coming in through the door. Can we not just talk to them?
And also, they don't know what questions to ask.
Exactly.
Because they don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. And if we're talking. If we're talking in acronyms or we're, you know, do Quakers believe in God? Well, I mean, one of the advantages of doing Quaker Quest is that those meetings that have done it have to think about how they're going to respond to those kinds of questions. So we actually do in-reach and then we can do outreach. But we should just be able to say, do Quakers believe in God? Historically, absolutely. Today, people may have different terms for it. Yes.
And I wonder if you had any afterwards about afterwards.
Mm. Well, afterward in my meeting was a disaster. So, because it became a discussion about the ministry, which some people wanted to do, you know, there'd been really interesting ideas, but also we have one room. So anyone coming, you know, having tea and coffee was then trapped by this afterward discussion. And, you know, it could go on 50 minutes, and in the end we had to abandon it. And I have been stuck in a meeting in America for 55 minutes while people offered contributions, like a meeting of 70 people, where people offered contributions that weren't quite ministry. So I'm not a great fan of it, though I know it's worked very well for some meetings. I think it needs to be managed well by the elders. It's, again, an elder... eldership responsibility. It might be that you do it monthly. It might be you do it in another room after notices, if you have notices. It may be that, like Bakewell meeting in Derbyshire, you turn to your neighbour for it for 5 minutes. You know, there's lots of different ways we can do that. Does it need to involve the whole meeting? Does it need to be every week? And most importantly, what is it really for? What is it really trying to do? And I think that needs to be really clear, and elders need to be clear if they're suggesting we have it. Why are we having this? So it might be it gets combined with other things like prayer concerns or things like that. Well, that's a different kind of thing. It's not an afterword. That's a time for prayer concerns. And in some American meetings, you might have that... say 5 minutes before the end, particularly in the Philadelphia region, you'll have someone, probably an elder, saying, as we draw towards the end of our worship, are there joys, concerns, or prayers that people want to offer. And there's 5 minutes then for people to say, well, you know, I'd really like your prayers for my friend who's going into, you know. Now, we've only got an hour, and we're tending to shorten our worship by half an hour a century. So I'm a little bit anxious about adding other things in, but that's I often stand up in meeting and ask for prayers for something, but I usually do it towards the end. And I think it would be, you know, reasonable to do that towards the end of meeting. And it offers that space. And joys as well. You know, I'd like to celebrate this, and you know, so. And then maybe have afterward, separately. Yeah. Sorry. I do beg your pardon. I'll come back to you. My meeting is now doing that on the fifth Sunday. When there's a fifth Sunday in the month, we have all age. It's about to say how useful all age worship is to bridge for younger people, but also for everyone. And my meeting has all age worship when there's a fifth Sunday in the month, and it has fed everybody. It's basically semi-programmed worship. Someone needs to organise it. Or think through what might be helpful for the group, but it's fed everyone. For some people, we need a bit more than just the silence, or it's helpful to have a change, and you know, and it's been really of great value, and we're going to carry that on. So, yeah. Right. Sorry. Experience of committee work, that you know, I've had just stunning times, really, you know, really serious and really fun, you know, and friendships that have been forged, that have, you know, carried on over the decades. I'm not sure if we've had more joyful times or not. That's interesting to think about. I think our image is not of a joyful people. You know, if you mention Quaker out there, they're likely to think of the porridge packet Puritan, or you know, and we may need to be a bit more joyful. Some of our new outreach posters look a bit serious as well. You know, a couple of years ago, there came some very dark and sort of very serious people in suits, you know, gazing out, talking about Quakerism. So we might need to manage our image a little bit more positively. The Jehovah's Witnesses, interestingly, are apparently huge on parties. for no good reason at all. That is what they will do. And they say, right, let's have a fighting meeting. And they just hire a cricket club or something and off they go. And so I'm sure we can learn about, parties. And it's a bit like the 7 hours on the train. It's those other times, whether it's in a committee or, we do bench waxing once a year, or gardening, or whatever it is. It's about doing things together. And it's joyful because we're actually, when we get to know each other, it's fun and we have laughter and things like that. So I hope we could be joyous and, known to be joyous, because that will indeed, draw people to us, I think. Oh, is it really? Okay. Okay. How are we doing? Are we ready for a cup of tea? Okay, good. Well, let's just... One more. It could be like a car auction.
Could you comment on that questionnaire that someone was filled in a couple of years ago? I can't exactly remember, but I don't think they asked quite a lot of questions. Can you tell us what the results were? Are you allowed to say?
Yep. Is this the British Quaker Survey?
About 7 sheets.
I know. Yes. Well, thank you very much, first of all, for filling it in. Seriously, because it was, there's no point sending these things up. Yes, indeed, yes. No, it was on pieces of paper. And it went to 50 meetings only, which were randomly selected. And so there were, and we had an 80% response rate. So thank you for being part of the 80%. There's a huge amount of information. There is a little bit of it on the Woodbrook website if you look up National Quaker Survey. But essentially we were able to compare it with surveys in 2003 and 1990. So if you didn't get one this time, 2023 maybe. So overall, some of those figures are in the lecture. We've got, there's a whole range of questions, and that's how I know that, for example, 88% of us have come in as adults. The average age is 43 of coming in. The average age of our yearly meeting is 64. So actually, only about half of us are in work. And this kind of thing, that we're more likely to be in the professional classes. That we're 98.9% white. All that's from the survey. I now know also that 57% of us will say that we believe in God, compared with 72% of us 10 years ago. But also, this time we had a statistician on the team who did some really good stuff, and you can read about that in the lecture as well, that there appears to be three kinds of clusters of believing, and there is a sort of 20% who are more likely to say they don't believe in God, that they're not Christian, that they might be humanist, that they don't think prayer, they don't pray at all. There's then 50% who are half and half going to say they believe in God, and believing in God is a very difficult question. What do you mean by God? What do you mean by belief? And we know from interview that different people who believe the same thing tick different boxes. So we know that questions are always difficult. But half, middle group, half and half believe in God, half likely to pray. And then 30% who might be seen as more traditional Quakers, highly likely to pray, highly likely to believe in God, more likely to call themselves Christian. And it's interesting because I wasn't expecting that large of a group of people in that category. And it may be that they're less represented in the letters pages of the Friend. It might be that that's a group of people who have felt more on the back foot in recent decades, less sure that they still belong in Quakerism. But what's also very interesting is went to interview people following the survey. And when you interview people, and someone's a clear Christian theist, and someone's said they're a non-theist, and you look at the interview transcripts, it's very difficult to tell who is who. Because every belief statement is hedged around with this perhaps and for now and, what's important is this, that and the other. That actually we shouldn't be thinking of each other as necessarily theologically different, but rather that we have a huge commonality in the way in which we believe, whatever it is that we believe. Okay? And that we are clearly a single group of liberal friends, but who've just got a little fuzzy around the edges. And, you know, a little unsure about, you know, being confident about helping our meetings grow spiritually and being clear. And that's really why I have such a lot of optimism and hope. I used to be called kind of Eeyore in the 1990s, named as a prophet of doom in one article. And I'm all kind of optimistic, obviously in an inward kind of Quaker way. But, you know, the sort of it's, you know, I'm excited about what we can do. And everywhere I go, I feel I find signs of hope and encouragement. And I hope you'll take that away from today. So maybe we can just close with a few minutes, and then we'll get to the kettle.